So tonight I'm going to be talking about our relationship to thinking. And just, you know, the last time I was here, I talked about our relationship to time. And what I, the way I began to talk was by saying that one way that we can understand this path to awakening is that it's really examining and developing this new relationship to our momentary experience. Different kind of relationship to what arises moment after moment in our lives. So the way we do that is first we're called upon to first become aware of what is our relationship to experience moment after moment. And then we find ways to cultivate a new relationship to our experience and to allow a new relationship to arise. This is to everything that really arises in our internal experience. To a sound, to a feeling, to a pain, to sorrow, to joy, and even to thinking, to thought, to the wandering mind. So that's what I want to explore with you tonight, is that relationship. Is what's our usual relationship? The things that I want to explore with you in particular is what's our usual relationship to thinking, the common relationship that we have to thought. And what's a new relationship to thinking that can lead us further on this path towards liberation? But not only that, I also want to share with you reflections on our usual relationship to thinking in terms of that tool of thinking. How do we utilize thinking? How do we utilize reflection? And to share with you a way to reflect and a way to actually engage in thinking that leads to liberation, that the Buddha was speaking about. And I want to begin by offering kind of two metaphors or two stories that I'll come back to again and again in order to help us understand the role of thinking or the role of thought within this practice. So the first story is probably a story that many of you have heard. It's about a fellow that some people call him the Laughing Buddha. You know, have you seen those statues of the Buddha with the big belly? Mm-hmm. So it's Hotei, yeah. And so in Chinese it's Putai, which I think literally means cloth sack. So he's named after what he always carried around with him, which was this cloth sack. And he was known as this Bodhisattva, and he was known to just be in town. So he would actually hang out on the streets playing with children. And he was really this joyful practitioner, this joyful Bodhisattva. And he was known to have this great depth of wisdom. And so one day a practitioner came up to Hotei, and as Hotei was walking along with the sack, and asked him, "Please explain to me the essence of this practice, the essence of this path." And Hotei just let go of his sack. Mm-hmm. Really, that's what this path is about, right? It's going towards liberation through letting go. Not through acquiring, but through letting go. This is what we gain skill in, is this process of letting go. And then the practitioner said, "Well, what next?" And Hotei picked up his sack and walked on. So it's not only learning how to let go, it's learning how to utilize those things within our sack. So it's the same thing with thinking. The first thing that we need to cultivate the skill in is letting go of thought, which I'll speak more in detail about. But it's not only that, it's how do we engage in thinking? Thinking is such, I mean, it's part of what it is to be a human being. We are thinking creatures. So how do we utilize that? So the first thing I want to point out, which I feel is very important, is to point out that thinking is not the problem. And it's so many times, have you noticed how thinking becomes the problem when you meditate? Anyone ever notice that? All of a sudden, thinking's the enemy. And I get asked that question so much. My mind chatters so much. How do I get rid of that? And it is important to really allow the mind to settle so there's not as much chatter. But a lot of times what's beneath that is that thinking is the enemy. Mm-hmm. And we're out to get the enemy. So that's a common relationship that we have to thought. And it's important to remember there are no enemies in this practice. There are no enemies. And that includes thinking. We're not here to exile thinking. We're actually here to cultivate a new relationship to it. So a little bit more about our usual and common relationship to thought, to thinking, that I'm sure some of you can relate to. And one way to get a sense of that is asking the question, which I find is just a good practice in itself, is asking, where do you usually reside? Where is your home throughout the day? Where are you residing? Anybody notice that they reside in thinking? That's our home. That's what we've made our home. So it's become the home that we live in, is thought. And I think that's one of the early insights in the meditation, right? You start to meditate and you realize, wow, my life is all about thinking. That's what it's about. And when you examine that a little bit more closely, what you might discover also is that most of our experience of our lives, of the world, is really mediated through description and interpretation. We have some experience, and it's not really the direct experience that we reside in, but it's more our description of it, or interpretation of it, or ruminating about it. That's the world that we usually reside in. That's our home. That's kind of the usual and common relationship to thought. And not only that, we're lost in it. That's the other common relationship to it. Someone asked the Thai teacher Ajahn Buddhadasa to describe the world in three words. He said, lost in thought. That's the world we live in, lost in thought. Maybe some of you can relate to this. Yeah. And I think it's important to see that when we're lost in thought, we're really living in this way of being disconnected. That consists of disconnection. I'm not with the world. I'm not with the person that's next to me. I'm with my thoughts. There's something rather tragic about that. And I think it's important to see that, to come to see that, because then we can start to see the importance of entering upon a path that's about liberation. The Zen poet Ryokan has this beautiful, very beautiful short poem that describes being in the world in a way that's not residing in thought. That's not his main home. So this is his poem. He says, "There's a bamboo grove in front of my hut. Every day I see it 1,000 times, yet never tire of it." So every day he sees this bamboo grove in the front of his hut, and he never tires of it. So what does that require? That requires not being hindered by the thought, bamboo grove, but really connecting with it, contacting it. That's the direction that we want to go in. This is the direction that we want to go in this practice. And have you noticed this in your own lives, how, again, our lives are dominated by some concept? A lot of times we can notice that around people. We get up in the morning, we go to work. Oh, there's my boss. There's my boss. Uh-oh. It's the same old boss that gives me the same old problems. And there she is. There he is. We do that with all kinds of people in our lives. We do it to ourselves. And then we tire of ourselves and of others in that kind of situation. This is the usual, our usual and common relationship to thinking. It dominates our world. We reside there. And I want to take it even a step further. Have you noticed, if you really examine or reflect upon the suffering in your life, have you noticed that it's mostly about the thoughts around, like some horrible event happens in your life. The event happens and it's over. And then what we really suffer from is all the thoughts and maybe the emotions that get connected with those thoughts. That's really where a lot of the suffering is coming from, right? Have you noticed that? I find it rather shocking. Mark Twain put it really well. He said, "I am an old man and have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened." So the Buddha actually had a word for this quality of thought that I'm beginning to point towards, that I want to explore with you. And the word in Pali, the Pali's being the language of early Buddhism, is papancha, which a lot of times it's translated as proliferations of the mind or complications of the mind. And it has that, it's really that quality of thought that has that wandering quality to it that we get lost in. All of us have experienced that in meditation. We become really familiar with papancha while we meditate. And one way to get a sense of the definition is to divide up the word. So it's papancha. Pa actually means going out or spreading out or diffusing. And then pancha, if some of you know some of the Pali from, for example, the precepts, pancha silam, is five. So it's going out in five directions. And then when you reflect on that quality of wandering mind, it has that sense, right? It's diffusing. It's going out all over the place. Out in five directions. In these many different directions. It's proliferating. It's complicating things. And in order to get a better sense of papancha, I want to share with you how the Buddha describes how papancha arises. Actually, he describes it in a few different ways, but I'm going to just read to you the way he explains it, and then I'll go through this explanation. So it's quite packed. So he says, dependent on I, on the I, and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as a requisite condition, there is feeling. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. What one thinks about, one complicates. And the word for complicates, one papanchizes, you could say. It's the verb of papancha. Based on what a person complicates, papanchizes, the perceptions and categories of complication, of papancha, assail her, they assail him, with regard to past, present, and future forms cognizable via the eye. So let's unpack this a little bit so we can get a sense of, because it will give us a clearer feeling for really what papancha is and how it arises in our practice and in our lives. So he begins with, maybe I'll just give an example. So I'm sitting here, and I hear a sound. So the hearing of the sound would be contact. So what's needed for that is the organ, my ear organ. That's one thing, three things are needed. That, the sound, and ear consciousness. And when all three of those are present, you have contact. So then there's hearing. There's the hearing of a sound. So that's the first thing. And then with contact as a requisite condition, once there's contact, there is feeling. And what he means by feeling is that experience is either going to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So I'm sitting here, I hear the sound of a car, and it's like, ew. Okay? It's a little bit unpleasant. And then once there's feeling, he says what one feels, one perceives. So perception... It might be a little bit different than the way we use it in English, but it's when my mind hears the sound, it's kind of unpleasant, and then it says, oh, car. Oh, interesting. It's a car. So it's this small label. It's this small kind of mental label of identifying what's there. Oh, car. So it's perceiving it. We hear something, oh, that's a bird. Oh, that's a person. So it's kind of like a thought, but it's very basic. This is perception. So perception arises. This always arises. And then what one perceives, one thinks about. And this is very interesting, because you'll notice that Papancha is a particular kind of thinking. When he says what one thinks about, the word for think here is vitaka. And so that means applied thought. So, oh, car. Well, that sounds like it sounds like Sally's car. So there now it's not only car, but it's like, oh, that sounds like Sally's car. So the mind has now applied that thought to that experience. It's car, oh, car, to the perception, and now it's, oh, that's Sally's car. But then what one thinks about, one complicates. Oh, that's Sally's car. I think she has my cookbook. I can't believe it. I gave it to her 6 months ago. She didn't have it has this really great green bean recipe in it. I served it last night to John and Jerry. And I thought it was great. They obviously didn't. I just wonder if they think I'm a bad cook or something. Is it the mushrooms in it? That's Papancha. Ooh, we're off to the racetrack, right? And again, I want to point out a few of the characteristics of Papancha now. So based on what a person complicates, so what Papancha is, this whole story about Sally and green beans and cookbooks, these complications start to assail him or her. They start to assail me. So what happens is it's not the mind engaging in thought. All of a sudden, I'm a victim of my thought. Do you ever have that feeling? Like, whoa, I have been taken over. So this is another quality of Papancha. It victimizes us. It switches it around so it feels like thought is victimizing us. Another quality of Papancha. And then there's one other quality, and I want to share with you a question that a monastic asked the Buddha. So he asked the Buddha, seeing in what way is a practitioner unbound, clinging to nothing in the world? So how does a practitioner come to being unbound, to really letting go, to liberation? And the Buddha says, the practitioner should put an entire stop to the root of complication classifications. The practitioner should put a stop to the root of Papancha. And the root of Papancha, Buddha says, is this, I am the thinker. Very interesting. So what's at the root of Papancha is this quality of I am. It's all centered around me. Right? Oh, Sally, my cookbook. Mm-hmm. That green bean recipe that I'm invested in. Mm-hmm. I'm very invested in how John and Jerry tasted it. And now I have this identity crisis that I might be a bad cook. And so another quality of Papancha is it really centers around me a lot of times, around some form, some identity, some creation of an identity. So these are the qualities. And this is what we want to become curious about, these kind of qualities that are there. And then that's part of the assailing me. I become victimized from that. Because then there's this identity, and then there's usually suffering involved. Is this making sense? Mm-hmm. How this arises? So then And the question is, so what's the new relationship to thinking? This is our usual relationship to thought. We're lost so much in papancha. So how do we cultivate, first of all, how do we cultivate a new relationship to thought? What's this going to look like? And a lot of it is just doing what we're doing in meditation. It's letting go of thought. It's coming back to being here with the breath, with the sound, with the sight, to really being with our direct experience. So we gain a practice in letting go of thinking and coming back again and again and again. And with that repetition, we can start to find a new home. We can start to reside in a different place. Instead of residing in thinking, we can begin to reside in awareness. And a lot of this practice, one way of getting a sense of it is seeing that we're just changing our home. We're changing our home from thinking to residing to being at home in awareness. And then we just keep thinking in the tool shed. And then when we need that tool, we go out to the tool shed and we get it and we use it. That's the kind of relationship that we want to thought, where our home is a different place and thinking is in the tool shed. But just letting go is not going to be all of what it is to cultivate this new relationship to thought. The other thing that we need to do is we need to start to see thinking, see it clearly. So a few things about this clarity around thought. One is seeing that a thought is just a thought. It sounds so basic, right? But I know many of you here have experienced how powerful it is to know that a thought is just a thought. One way to get a sense of this power is to explain what happens when we don't see a thought as just a thought. If there's a thought that arises in your mind and you don't see it, that's just a thought, then that is your reality. That is your world. That is the reality that you're living in, is that thought. That is the world that you're living in until you see that it's just a thought. Right? And some of you probably have experienced that, is that that's the reality you live in, is that thought. And then when you see it, oh, that's just a thought. Oh, interesting. There's a lightness, right? Yeah. And right there, we can start getting a taste of a little bit more freedom around the thinking process. That's a new relationship. That's a radically different relationship. Very simple, but radically different. I'm sure many of you have seen the bumper sticker, "Don't believe everything you think." It should be changed. "Don't believe anything you think." Again, we don't believe anything we think, but we don't get lost in that reality of whatever thought is there. And it's asking, is that the reality that you want to live in? Do you want to live in the reality of thought? Or do you want to live in this world in a different way? And if we really want to live in this world in a different way, we need to engage in cultivating this new relationship. And in cultivating this new relationship, it requires this repetition of doing the meditation practice, of following ethical conduct, of following on this path to cultivate this new relationship. Another thing that can help to really start to see the dynamic of thinking, of changing this new relationship, is to also notice what underlies thinking. And what I mean by that, in some of you, when I ask this question of, you know, noticing what how thinking arises this evening. Usually the way I become curious about that is I sense into my body. So tonight what I noticed is that when I began to sit, there was this agitated, unsettled feeling there. And I sensed that into my body, and that seemed to create, or that seemed to be underneath some of that wandering mind. And then when that settled, the mind started to settle, and I was able to really start to be with the breath. And then there'd be this wave of excitement, there's this pleasurable excitement, and that created some of the wandering mind, and then that settled down. But a lot of times what I'm usually doing is I become curious about the dynamic in terms of noticing the condition that's there through the body. What's the soil that's allowing this plant of thought, this plant of papancha, to arise? And I find it's a wonderful way to really ground my practice when there's a lot of the wandering mind, and also see the dynamic of how thought arises. I guess I just want to emphasize once again, and I know many of you experienced it, that this is, I feel, one of the most powerful things about this practice is really becoming liberated from our thinking. You know, I know I've experienced that, and I've actually, I think we were just talking about it last night too, about what a relief that is, not to believe our thinking. Another practice that can help kind of off the cushion in terms of cultivating a new relationship to thought is to just throughout your day, just to notice when an opinion arises in your mind, when you have an opinion. And just to notice it's just an opinion. It'll be really interesting, I promise you. Because it's a quality of thought that we get lost in often. And it divides us from others often. And it's something that our identity gets really intertwined with, is our opinions. So you might want to become curious about that. Oh, that's an opinion. Oh, there it is. Interesting. It's just a thought. What's that like? So again, it's cultivating this new relationship to thinking. So this is all this is about dropping the bag. So going back to putai, it's about letting go of that sack. That's that part of it. But now, how do we pick up the sack? And I want to first talk about how we usually engage in reflection or in thinking. When we've decided that we need to think about something or utilize thought, how do we usually do that? And I think one way that we utilize discursive thinking or reflection is I think mostly what we're doing, and we get this from our educational system, and it's not a horrible thing, but I think it has its limits, is that we become very accustomed to kind of rearranging ideas and rewording ideas. But nothing new really emerges. And so I'm using this word new a little bit different. So we might learn new ideas or new concepts. We might get more information off the internet. And then we learn how to rearrange all that information. But there's nothing new about it. And what I mean by new, there's nothing alive about that thought or that concept. Just something that we've got off the internet, something that we've got from some teacher at school. It's a very useful skill to have. But there is a great limit to thinking and reflecting in that way. And the Buddha, I feel, is pointing to a different kind of reflection than that, than what we've learned at school. And when I was writing this, I was reflecting on the internet. And one of the wonderful things I find about having the internet is because there's so much, there's a wealth of information there. And there is, information can be very helpful. I definitely think that. But I think the other thing that we can notice about the internet is it's shown me very clearly the limits of information. We can sit down on the internet all day long and not be any more liberated than we were in the morning. Have you noticed that? Yeah. But we place so much value on that, on the information that we stuff in our heads. But there's nothing new about that. I want to be very clear about that. There's nothing new about that kind of thinking. And what I want to propose to you is a way of thinking that the Buddha also, I feel, is pointing towards, that's about a new way of thinking, an alive way of thinking. So I want to give a number of examples of this. I can think of some. So maybe we come to this practice and we're introduced to this idea that meditation is a liberating practice. Meditation is a liberating practice if we engage in it. So we have this idea that engaging in meditation leads to liberation. we engage in meditation. So we begin to engage in meditation. We have this idea, and so we engage in it. From this idea, we have this concept, this thought that we picked up maybe on the internet. And then lo and behold, we sit down and our mind wanders and wanders, and then the thought comes up, I can't meditate. I can't do this. This is horrible. I'm a horrible person. I can't do anything. And then what happens is, now this idea that we got off the internet just goes to cultivate this pattern that we already have. There's nothing new about that idea that meditation is liberating. Now it's been twisted to fit this idea that we already live with, that I'm a bad person. Do you see how there's nothing new about that? This happens often in this practice. We come across some idea or concept in this practice, and then it just gets usurped by this old pattern, this old way of thinking, this old way of being, and there's nothing new about it. In some ways, this is the beginning of practice, is we just have to do that for a while. I was just remembering when I was doing the Zen monk thing, I think a year or two into it, just to remember, it's horrible. But we were doing this koan practice, which is it's a crazy practice. But so I was working with the Zen master, and I came back from this interview and realized that I must have spent a year just entrenched in this old pattern that had infused my meditation. And it was bone-crushing to see that, wow, I've just been using meditation just to fulfill my old patterns. Nothing new here whatsoever. And luckily, I was happy that I saw it then, because then I saw how miserable I was from the way I was meditating. And then I could let go of it. But there wasn't anything new about Buddhism or meditation at that stage in my practice. So another example, this is a more obvious example, but it still speaks to the practice. So we have this idea that it's wonderful to cultivate compassion. So we have this idea to cultivate compassion, and maybe we have the idea to, I should be kind, I should be compassionate. When we learn about these ideas, maybe we go work in a soup kitchen or something like that. And so we're engaging kind of in different behaviors, but we're missing really what the Buddha was talking about in terms of compassion or kindness. And that was, it's stemming from this heartfelt quality. And compassion's really about the heart being moved by the suffering of another. That's a living experience that transforms us. When we allow ourselves to be moved in a compassionate way, not in an overwhelmed way, but in a compassionate way, then compassion is all of a sudden a new idea. It's a new concept that is striking our entire being. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. Sure, some of you experience that it has a new quality. That's what I mean by new. And that's different than the idea, the abstract idea of compassion. So the Buddha used a number of different terms. It's fascinating. The schools of Buddhism that I trained in were so much about meditation that they didn't speak about wise reflection, about reflecting on things. And then I started to read the early discourses, and the Buddha is continually talking about reflection, thinking about things, very often. Just that all the schools of Buddhism that I went to, it's like they didn't pay attention to those suttas. It was very selective. Reflection is a very important part of this practice. I mean, for me, the meditation is still core, but reflecting is also very important. And some of the... I'm not going to go over all these terms. There's one term that I really want to hone in on, but I just want to share with you a few of the terms that you'll find. Like, there's this term, sampajanya, which has, again, all these... a wide variety of connotations. But this Pali word, it can mean alertness, or clear comprehension, or discernment. And there's different areas that one wants to be discerning in. Is this time and place suitable? Suitability. It's just one area of sampajanya, which requires reflecting. Another one is dhammavicaya, which is a lot of times translated as investigation. And again, it has this wide range of meaning of just becoming from just curious in the meditation object to reflecting on the Dhamma or the things that are arising in terms of the Dharma. Again, it takes the thinking process sometimes in this act of investigation. And then there's this other Pali word, vitaka. Actually, I'm not going to go into that. That's another word that the Buddha will use in terms of engaging in thought. And another one that I became interested in, and I think it will give us more of a feeling so I can speak a little bit more about this new way of engaging in thought, is this term, yoniso manasikara. And I can get to it. And yoniso manasikara, it's usually translated as appropriate attention. So manasikara is to reflect upon, to attend to. Yoniso, yoni, I'm sure many of you know that, refers to actually the womb. So actually it refers to the womb, and in a more general way, to the origins of things. So yoniso manasikara is having attention or appropriate attention to the origins of things. Actually, Joanna Macy, in her book Mutual Causality, she goes a little bit further with this term, and she mentions that yoniso also could also have this feeling of wholeness, so that when we sense in or we reflect upon something, we reflect upon it from a standpoint of wholeness, which I find also very fascinating. And she combines it with getting a sense of how things arise, rather than dividing things up in a linear way, getting a sense of wholeness. And I'll give you an example of this quality of thought. There's some other qualities to yoniso manasikara that the Buddha talks about. The opposite of that, inappropriate attention. And what is inappropriate attention? It is that which is concerned with being obsessed with identity. Well, do I exist? Maybe I don't exist. Is there a self? Is there not a self? What am I? Who am I? That's inappropriate. That's an inappropriate question. So it's interesting that he's very clear that it's not going to be like papancha. Papancha centers around an identity. Yoniso manasikara doesn't have that quality to it. Another quality of this is, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu points this out, is that it's not about abstract thought. It's connected to our experience. So I want to give an example of this quality of thinking. Hopefully this will make sense. So I come to Buddhism and I hear, just as I said, I heard the story about Hote dropping the bag, and it's all about letting go. That's what Buddhism is about. It's all about letting go. So I come across an experience where there's this grasping onto something like I'm a horrible person, I'm a wonderful person, or grasping on anything, or I'm grasping on this bell. I want to have this bell. It could be that simple. And a way that I could usually, a usual common way of utilizing thought is, oh, here's grasping. I need to let go. Okay? And then I try to let go. And a lot of times, I've noticed when there's, I should let go, in this sense, one lets go, and then it's like, oh my God. And then it's, then the grasping happens again. So it's, oh, I need to let go. Oh my God. I need to let go. You ever notice that? I need to let go of this in my life. And then we let go, and then we're just back at grasping again. It doesn't work. So that's one way of thinking about it. I'm grasping on to this thing in my life, and I need to let go. And then we try to let go, and it really doesn't. That's not what the Buddha's talking about. So that's one way of thinking about something. Another way of attending, reflecting, is, oh, interesting, there's grasping, oh, let me bring some attention to this. Oh, interesting. There's grasping. Yeah, and there's tightness. Oh, I sense a sense of tightness there. Not only tightness, wow, when I sense into all of this, I sense something that finds safety in grasping. Mm-hmm. Wow, there's something that's afraid. Oh, interesting, there's something that's afraid that really needs to hold on. Wow, interesting. Well, let me just be with this holding on and see what arises. Oh, yeah, and as I really start to clearly see it, oh, this is interesting, there's a little bit of letting go. Oh, interesting. Oh, and it clamps up again because there's some fear. Oh, that's different than the letting go. Oh, and then one finger. Oh, that actually feels much better than grasping. This feels like a relief. Ah, let me try some more of that. Ah, yeah, yeah. Wow, when I'm not grasping onto this, there's not as much suffering. And I can experience that. There's an experience of that. And then no longer, when there's a direct experience of that and I reflect upon that in this manner, there's no need to grasp anymore. There's a deep realization through the wholeness of the experience. And then letting go will happen. Do you see the difference in this? Mm-hmm. How the first letting go is just an idea about Buddhism. It's an idea about this practice. Yet this is reflecting on our direct experience. Reflecting on it in terms of seeing the nature of suffering, dissatisfaction. And when we clearly reflect and think, we can engage in thought at times around this, about different things that we're suffering about in our lives. Something new can emerge. But we need to go in with a few things. One is not knowing. I don't know what's going to come from being aware of this. So it's being with something with not knowing, with that which is not yet formed. This wisdom is not yet formed. That takes a lot, because usually what we do is we get scared and we just go back to our old concepts. So it requires that. It requires space. I need some space around this. I need to slow down with it. And it requires sensing into our body. So this is the new kind of thinking that we can engage in. Yeah, so may we cultivate a new relationship to thinking that leads all beings to liberation. Mm-hmm. Thank you.